Ecclesiastes Review and Ecclesiastes 3:1 through 3:11, the fourth talk in a series on Ecclesiastes, was presented by Wes Hurd on May 4, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Well, it's good to be here. This is I mentioned this before when I was teaching in Ecclesiastes the last time I was here. This is a very, very intimidating book in the Bible to take on. I was chatting with someone before this morning, our time this morning began, and this person was suggesting that I had a lot of guts for taking it on. Fools rush in. It's kind of that sort of thing. What I'd like to do this morning is review very quickly a little bit about Ecclesiastes, see if I can get us up to speed a little bit. And then I'd like to pick up where I was before. But by way of doing that, I'll have to review a little bit, just kind of run through the text of chapters 1 and 2, sort of highlighting some things, bring us to where we left off at the end of chapter 2 last time. And then spend the rest of our time and really focus on the first 11 verses of Ecclesiastes. I have the opportunity and responsibility of being here again next week, but I'm thinking that I'm not going to teach in Ecclesiastes next week. I'm going to try to bring this to a close for now, maybe come back to it sometime in the future. Next week, I want to pick up something that I think is a huge overarching purpose of the book of Ecclesiastes that I see, an aspect of that I see in in Jesus's ministry, and something that became a very, very central and large way and issue that how he interacted with both his disciples and with the public, the religious leaders, and the larger crowds that he taught and interacted with. And there's an interesting parallel there. I hope to be able to bring that out next week. Okay, just by way of background then, Ecclesiastes is a book of wisdom literature. It's poetry. It's Hebrew poetry. And Semitic poetry is not about rhyme, but it has parallels and it has rhythm, and it's mostly about ideas. The poetry carries its beauty and its power in the content rather than in the rhyme and the sound of the words and the parallel. It was written by the author, is given in the first, suggested in the first verse of the book, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Now, the word preacher is actually, in Hebrew, the word koheleth. Don't know if I've got that pronounced exactly right. But it basically comes from the root word of assembly. In other words, the assembly of the children of Israel being taught by someone who stands in front of the assembly is called the preacher, Koheleth. So Ecclesiastes is basically the words of Koheleth as he stands before the congregation and teaches them. Solomon, there's reason to think that Solomon authored at least most of this, if not all of it. He was obviously the son of David. He was actually the 10th son of David, King David, and he was the second son of Bathsheba and David. And whereas his father, David, had grown up among the common people, a shepherd, Solomon grew up in the palace in Jerusalem. He was always surrounded by riches, power, wealth, and the intrigue of ruling politics. He saw the heights and glory of royal power. He saw the chaos and tragedy of their lives as well. Being in the position that he was, he would have been privy to the comings and goings of other kings and rulers of other kingdoms in the surrounding area, Egypt, in the surrounding Mediterranean, Middle Eastern area. So he would have seen and heard about the impact of what those people's lives were like and how those rulers interacted with their people, and much of that at this time was very brutal and cruel. It was about power. Solomon himself reigned for a long period of time, roughly 40 years, over a vast, powerful, and extremely wealthy kingdom. This was made possible by the work of his father, David, who had set everything up and done a remarkable job of building the stages and the foundations for the kingdom, and Solomon took over. So King David had set up the political circumstances into which Solomon came, and they were very, very positive for the kingdom at this point in history. The political circumstances favored the safety and the wealth of Israel at this point. The major nations and powers around Israel at this time were Egypt, Assyria, and Babylon. And in each of those cases, there were circumstances relating to those political kingdoms that kept them in one way or another in check so that they couldn't threaten Israel at this point. In addition to that, Israel was geographically positioned at a place where they were in control of the main trade routes across that world, which was the center of the world for them at that point. So a lot of the surrounding culture, of the culture of the circumstances, are that Israel is in many ways at its pinnacle, at its peak as a political entity and as a kingdom. It's incredibly wealthy because it controls all this trade, and they're making huge amounts of money. Profit becomes a really important word in this poem and in the issues, that a very useful word, a very intriguing word that Solomon uses. Let me mention a few of those terms that would sort of give, again, a little more background to catch us up here. The big themes of Ecclesiastes. One of the terms is, again, greets us right at the very beginning of the book, where he says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun?" Right from the beginning, the writer, Koheleth, Solomon, the preacher, gives us his big themes, namely, that he's going to look at experience, at man's existence, under the sun. And what is intended there, I think, is to, he's intending to bracket reality in such a way that he's going to examine the nature of man's existence under the sun, that term being a metaphor for the fact that where the sun shines, in other words, the haven and dwelling and dwelling place of mankind, is what he's going to look at. He's not looking beyond that. He's not looking to the heavens. He's not looking. I mean, he's really going to examine and focus what it is that happens under the sun. And then he concludes, and he says this right from the beginning, that everything ends up, in the end, being a vanity or being futile. The word is the word breath, Hebrew word for a mere breath, and the whole idea there is that this is to be compared with some. This is an insubstantial thing. It's insubstantial as compared to something more concrete and material, something substantial. So he's saying that in the end, all of the doings and existence of man ends up being colored by this pall of futility, that in the end it all seems like breath compared to something substantial. And he gets on and talks about that. What is the more substantial? Or at least he alludes to that. He talks about man's task. That God has given man a task in the world. And he refers to this task that's going to occupy the human race, human existence, as being a vexing, troubling, wearisome effort. And that in the end, after all the effort, it ends up being futile, is the word that's used. Interestingly, the writer refers to God no less than 36 times in the book. But interestingly as well, it's always the term, the name of God is always Elohim, as compared to the term Yahweh. By the way, I actually released these balloons in here because it's going to get so heavy that I wanted you to be able to float off, kind of, you know, take a break and then come back. He uses the term Elohim, which is the more generic term for God. It's the name of God as the creator, as the sovereign over existence, but it is not the name of Yahweh, which is the covenant, the personal covenant name that God gave to his people Israel. So, and it's certainly the case that Solomon or the writer would not, he certainly would have known that. So he could have chosen to use that name, but he chooses not to. And that's an intriguing issue in the book, which I'm not sure I've come to the end of yet, but I have some thoughts in that direction that might come out while I'm working here this morning. But the other major theme that comes out, overarching theme in all this, along with the boundaries of man's existence under the sun, is the fact that God, Elohim, the creator, is the master of creation, that he rules, that he's the boss. He is the one who sets the boundaries and controls reality, and who, under whom and with whom man must have to do. I noticed something when I was looking this time, as a distance from the last point where I left off. I noticed something I hadn't seen before regarding this major theme of God's existence. And that is that it seems to me that the very structure of the poem, the literary structure of the poem itself, has an interesting relationship and almost is a metaphor, or that the structure itself actually tells us something. It's like it's a symbol or a metaphor for the message itself. What do I mean by that? Well, it seems to me, at first the whole book, when you're reading through it, you get two impressions. One is that it's very, that's a collection of proverbs, that it's, you know, that's kind of this dark picture of the existence of man, and you know, you might even wonder, why this is a downer, why is this even in the Bible? But along the way, you run into these, so there's sort of a structure and a story, and yet there's no narrative, and you read things at the end of the book that might just as well have been said at the beginning of the book. You read things at the beginning that might have just as well appeared in the middle or the end. And so there's a kind of random feeling to it on the one hand. On the other hand, as you read through it a few times, you begin to see this. There is a kind of pattern in the book, in the poem. And there is a beginning and there is a conclusion, but then there's this pattern, this structure that goes through it. And this, it seems to me that the purpose of the book is to preach to Israel and to remind every Israelite of their true nature before the Creator by demonstrating from observed experience, that is, in a sense, Koheleth's research, to take that research and take those observations and draw some conclusions and to put those conclusions out as reminders to Israel, reminders to every Israelite of the boundaries of their existence, both as a nation and as individuals, and in a sense, to talk about the nature of the contradictions built into and inherent in human experience. So it's like boundaries and contradictions. Boundaries and contradictions is this theme that goes back and forth through the book. So, for example, one other point. I stumbled across the fact that there's reason to believe that this book was read to the congregation as a matter of ceremonial ritual at the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, there are two great feasts in the history and life of Israel. One was the Feast of Tabernacles, which happened in the fall at the end of the harvest, and the other is Passover that happened in the spring. They're roughly 6 months apart. The Feast of Tabernacles was had a twofold purpose. One is that it's a commemoration of a celebration of the end of the harvest and the supply and general provision of God for the children of Israel. That is, the harvest has come in, and now God has supplied our needs, and now we're going to celebrate and give thanks. So there's this giving thanks and celebration for that at the end of the harvest, as well to the general provision of God for the children of Israel. There's also a very strong element of celebrating and remembering and giving thanks for the way God provided for Israel as they were liberated from Egypt and from the bondage that they were under in Egypt. As they went out into the wilderness, they were completely at the mercy of God. God led them out into a vast territory that was nothing short of a complete desolate wilderness. There was nothing growing out there. There was no water out there. How in the world are they going to feed this, you know, thousands and thousands of men, women, and children? And they became aware of that as they went, and they grumbled to Moses, of course. But God provided. And so the Feast of Tabernacles has this sense of wanting to commemorate God's provision. And also the Feast of Tabernacles, as you may know, is a time when the practice is to build a booth, a little kind of shed booth kind of thing, like a tent, in a sense, outside the house or on the roof of the house, made from temporary things like branches and elements of tree and leaf and things like that. So it's just this sort of temporary dwelling that the celebration and of the festival is that you go, the whole family during the week lives in the temporary tent. It's Jewish camping. You go out into the tent for a week, it's 7 or 8 days, and the whole picture and experience this experience is intended to picture the temporariness of existence on earth, that and the frailty with which we exist before in the world under the sun, that this is a very frail shelter that we live in. But God provides for us in spite of the fact that we live from hand to mouth in a very frail condition. So Ecclesiastes was read at the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. The reason, as we might imagine, would be to present these themes, and I would argue that the structure of Ecclesiastes in its presentation of these boundaries that God sets for man and these contradictions in the experience of man, that these are themes that go through the book and are entirely appropriate to be read at a feast where the commemoration is we remember how frail we are. We remember our condition before God. We remember our need and our dependence from God. So he presents these big themes like that God is in control, that God is the creator, and that in a sense it's this presentation of God the creator and man the creature and the great vast universe of difference between God the creator and man the creature. An emphasis on man being this utterly dependent creature whose boundaries are set. The parameters of his life and existence are set by God. So we get this picture of being under the sun. We get these pictures of man's limitations, language about the birth of existence and the end of existence and death. And ultimately, that only God, the final picture of God is that only God is the one who has the say in what's going on for the existence and experience of man. Then he inserts these smaller insertions, these smaller observations in the form of proverbs from experience, observed experience, and those contradictions sort of fill in the details. So it looks like this, if you can picture with me, a large statement and then a bunch of smaller brackets following that sort of fill in underneath the large statement, then another large statement, a restatement of the theme, a big boundary, and then a whole series of proverbs and observations and teachings that sort of fill in from the experience, observed experience of man, and then another great statement. So there's like this boundaries, contradictions, and it's not, and I'm not going to argue that it looks like that in a very ordered way, but that's the general feel that I get as I go through the book, and it occurred to me that very structure itself carries the message. That is, the idea of these large brackets of boundaries on man's existence, and then these smaller oppositions and contradictory experiences seem to fill in what it's like to live within the boundaries. Here we have the boundaries of man's existence, and here we have these examples and explications and observations, most of which are contradictory and ironic in nature. An example would be observations from nature in the first chapter, for example. He looks at nature and he sees the rivers going into the sea and cycling back in rain and raining back from the mountains back into the sea, and there's this sort of endless cycle. And he does the same thing with the wind. So he makes these observations of nature, and what we see is this sort of cycling like this. And although you don't immediately think of a cycle as being a boundary, there's a very real sense in which it is boundary. It isn't going anywhere. It's just a repetition. It's definitely bounded. And it's contradictory in the sense that, well, another example would be, he talks about great feats are possible, and in fact, he carries them off. He actually accomplishes, Solomon accomplishes amazing things. And then he steps back and looks at them, and he says, yes, I created great things, and I had a certain real enjoyment of those things. But then in the end, the contradiction is it doesn't really fulfill. It's in the end, it's like breath. It doesn't last. I thought that was interesting that the structure of the book itself actually carried some of the message, if you got it. Let me review very quickly where we are up to chapter 3. I read the first two verses. In that first section from 1 down through 11, there is this repetition, I said, of observing nature and of drawing some metaphors and similes from it that are about the experience of the existence of man. Namely, that everything ends up in these brackets and these contradictions and these cycles, and they don't really go anywhere. In the end, it all seems futile. And then in chapter, at the end of that chapter, that's 12 through, I think I got my numbers wrong on here in my notes, 12 through 17 or 18, he says he's going to set up a task for himself. And he's going to test with all of his powers as king and ruler to fulfill himself. He's going to use everything at his disposal to fulfill himself. And he begins with sensuality and pleasure, with the pleasure of aesthetics and beauty, with the aesthetics of pure material wealth and accumulation of things that are expensive and elaborate, and then with physical sensuality itself. And then in 12 through 17, he talks about he's going to test his own wisdom, and he's going to look at wisdom on the one hand and madness and folly on the other. So with his wisdom intact, he's actually going to look at wisdom, look at madness and folly, look at his own experience of those things, and test them to see if he can wring something substantial from them, something worth something, something beyond just futility or breath, as he's referring to it. And then this last section in chapter 2, from 18 through 26, he more or less, on the one hand, despairs over all his labor. He sees everything he's tried. He's done building and physical material things, architecture and art, and he's tried sexuality and sensuality and everything he can get from that, and all the goodness and the hedonism that his money could buy, which was a lot. And he concludes that it ends in futility. And then he says, I'm going to test my mind. I'm going to test the ideas. I'm going to test my experience from that perspective. I'm going to step back and look at it and see what results from that. And he says this, he concludes again, that it ends in futility. He even goes so far as to say that in the end, although wisdom is better than folly and madness, both the one who is wise and the one who is a fool fall under the ultimate leveler of death. So in the end, he's looking at the bracket at the end of life, and he's saying nobody messes with that bracket. It doesn't matter what you do, you cannot get beyond that boundary. That's something you are going to deal with. And as he sees it, that's the leveler. That's the one that levels rulers and paupers and the wise and the foolish. And then he says, on the other hand, he looks at all that labor and he says, I despair over it because I'm not getting what I really want from it, essentially. But then he says, but you have to enjoy what you do because it's a gift from, because you have to realize that it's a gift from God. So there's sort of a contradiction there. On the one hand, he's saying labor doesn't get us anywhere because it's all futile in the end. Look at all I've done, and he's calling it futile. And then he makes this other statement toward the end of chapter 2 where he says, but there's nothing better for a man than to eat, drink, and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? So there's this other sense in which labor, the best you're going to get, and there are some good things because they're gifts from God, the best you're going to get are these simple things. That the supply of food, to enjoy food with your friends and your family, to enjoy the work of your hand under the sun, realizing that that work under the sun is bracketed, that it isn't going to be of an eternal, enduring nature in the end. So then we come to the chapter 3, and as I mentioned, I'm only going to read. We're going to try to take up verses 1 through 11 here. So let's read through that. I'm reading from the New American Standard. It might be a little different than what you have. So he begins a new thought here, under the same themes that he's concerned with. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven. a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down, a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace, a time to shun embracing, a time to search, a time to give up as lost, a time to keep, a time to throw away, a time to tear apart, a time to sew together, a time to be silent, a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What profit is there to the worker or laborer, the one who labors, from that in which he labors or toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. Aside from this section, the first eight verses, being a part of one of the most famous rock and roll songs out there, which is probably the way most of us heard it the first time, this is a really amazing and very intimidating section of poetry to try to interpret and try to gather the essence. And I've taken a shot at it here, but I know that as long as I get to live and come back to this book, that there's going to be new stuff every time I look, and an unfolding. It's like layers and unfolding of something, because that's what art does. It presents you something, and then if it's really good, it keeps presenting in different ways. And certainly this would fit the bill there. First time I looked at this, I thought, well, of course, there's time. See the word time there? It's all the way through the whole thing. So it must be a meditation on time. And I think there's a certain sense in which it is. I believe, looking at it again and thinking about it at this point, I think it's more correctly a meditation that is a very interesting poetic way of saying the same thing that he's saying all the way through the whole book. Namely, that this is a meditation on the limits of man's existence. The limits of man's existence compared to, at the end, eternity, things that endure. So it's basically picking up that same those same themes that I'm suggesting of the bracketing of man's existence under the sun, and what does he get to do and what does he get to be under the sun. And then these pithy insights into the character of man's existence within those brackets under the sun and under God. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a slightly different translation, which I hope will help at least give a slightly different angle and maybe clarify a little bit about what's going on here. But I'm holding this tentatively as well. Okay, verse 1. There's an appointed time for everything. There's a time for every event under heaven. Two things here. One, everything has its foredetermined... I think the thrust of the language and everything is this. Everything has its foredetermined time, in which there lies both a determined point of time when it happens and a determined period of time or a season during which it shall continue. So there's this sort of this punctiliar sense in which God determines this is when it's going to happen, and then this other sense in which is it's going to happen this long, for this kind of duration, which is really interesting, and not the least to say, you know, behind the scenes here, he's saying, hey, you know what? God's the one who sets the agenda. He's the author. He's the one who's writing the story. Here, I think Koheleth presents an amazing series after this, an amazing series of observations about humanity under the sun that really, in a beautiful, poetic way, summarizes the breadth of man's experience. There are seven couplets in this section, from verse 2 down through 8. And each of these couplets, I think, portrays a very important, or a most important, even critical, universal experience of man. And again, they're as poetry, by the very nature of poetry, these are things that you come back and you ponder, you meditate on them, you think about what is that? You think about the implications of even a single word or a phrase, and you they're like seeds that grow and blossom. There's a lot more there than the first time you look. And there's also a sense, it occurred to me, that the whole book of Ecclesiastes, but this this section in particular, is what I could call a phenomenology, and I'll try to explain that in a second, a phenomenology of human experience. That is, human experience is made up of phenomena, that is, of elements of things that we do and think, the phenomena of our life. A phenomenology is a study of, in this case, human experience that brackets asking the questions, the larger questions of why, how did this happen, what was the motive, what was the reason, was God in charge of this? There's a certain sense in which, even though the writer definitely infuses the central fact of God's sovereign providence over reality and over creation, there's another sense in which he's kind of just outlining and explicating and giving examples of the phenomena of human experience without commentary. That's what a phenomenology is. It's just saying what happens, what's happening. It's just looking at the phenomena without drawing any conclusions. And there's a certain sense in which Ecclesiastes has that spirit about it, that it examines human experience, and in the end it does comment on it, but the thrust and the feel and the weight of it is just take a look, a steely-eyed, clear look at the experience of being human. This is it. And there's a certain sense in which one of the things, most disturbing things about this book is its lack of moral and ethical commentary on the phenomena. And I think there's a purpose behind that. I think he just wants to put it up in front of the face of the one who receives this information of this poem and say, do you identify? Do you see yourself? What about that? Think about that. So that's what I mean by a biblical phenomenology. In the second verse, to be born has its time, and to die has its time. To plant has its time, and to root up that which is planted has its time. Here you have the whole, it begins. What everything begins with is birth. Something is brought forth. And then the opposite of it is death. The same thing, the beginning of plant, the existence of a plant, is something is planted, and the end of it is it's being rooted up. So there's a coherence of thought, a unity of thought in this couplet about beginning, about the beginning and the end. By the way, all these, which we'll go through in the next few minutes, are, I think, as I already mentioned, are poetically pregnant and open to a wide application. So as we read these, we talk about being born and dying and planting and rooting up. Each of those terms is applicable to a wide range of human experience. In other words, you could think about being born and dying, planting and uprooting, and the metaphors, the similes that might bring to mind in light of economics, in light of politics, in light of social and personal relationships. Each one of these could be looked at through the lenses of some particular arena, some particular area of human life. So they're very general and very universal in that kind of, when you're looking at how do they relate. They relate to life, to a broad range of human experience, and they're universal. The next one, from the idea of rooting up, I think at the end of that moves to the next thought, which is death. So in verse 3, to put to death has its time, and to heal has its time. To pull down has its time, and to build has its time. So, and then you get a parallel here. But again, the thought has moved from the rooting up, the end of plant life, the end of the existence of a plant's life, to the notion of death. There's a time to for death to be, and a time for healing to happen. A time to pull down something, and to build has its time. Again, universal ideas and pictures that are not aimed at anything in particular, but just true of the large scheme of man's experience and existence. From verse 3 to verse 4, I think we shift from what are these large sort of macro themes of life and death, birth and death, building up, tearing down. Largely, those metaphors have to do with existence, that with existence and not existence. I think those verses are taking on those big ideas of existence and non-existence. From here, he moves and contrasts this with the limits of existence itself. In other words, he moves to some smaller concerns, more specific concerns. Again, the repetition of what I'm suggesting that the book might be structured under, which is these large brackets and large themes, and then examples and proverbs that manifest the truth that happens within the experience of those large brackets. So here he moves to some smaller observations. To weep has its time, and to laugh has its time. To mourn has its time, and to dance has its time. Again, a kind of parallel between weeping and mourning and laughing and dancing. I think what's in mind here is a kind of, in the second phrase, to mourn is about the mourning for the dead. And on the joyous occasion, the dancing refers to the joy in life. So there's a mourning about sadness, death, tragedy, and joy that comes from the experience that we have over marriages and festivals and occasions of celebration. Then from verse 4 to verse 5, I'm not sure the logic of the shift at that point gets a little... I'm not sure about that, but to throw stones has its time, and to gather stones together has its time. To embrace has its time, and to refrain from embracing has its time. I think this couplet is about social and personal relations. The idea of throwing stones and gathering stones together is a little bit... it's a little bit shaky. I'm not sure what's going on there. The help that I got in this was looking at a reference in 2 Kings. It turns out that when Israel, certain king of Israel was having battles with the Moabites, and the Moabites attacked Israel. Israel was people of Israel. As they walked by the fields of the Moabites, everyone picked up a stone and threw a stone into the field. The idea being that if you throw a bunch of big stones into the fields, it ruins them for being able to put a plow through them or to cultivate them. So if everybody throws the stones and every field is covered with stones, it pretty much puts that field out of commission. The same thing, gathering stones together would be the idea of clearing a field or taking stones out, and has the notion of construction. So there's sort of a destructive and then a constructive opposite to it. To embrace has its time, and to refrain from embracing, I think, again, the spirit of the same thing, whereas this has perhaps a focus on the more personal. The stones idea has the idea of a corporate, a bunch of people doing something together, to either throw stones or to gather them up. The second one has more, and both of these have to do with human hands, with doing things manually with our hands and personally. To embrace has its time, to refrain. Obviously, this has to do with a more, perhaps a more personal relationship, a love relationship with someone else. So there's a contrast of destroying and cultivating nature, or in interacting with nature and creation in the fields, and then the same thing in the relationship between people. Perhaps a theme being an issue of alienation here. Perhaps that's what's the social and personal relationships and alienation, which is inevitable in human experience. And this is all followed or contrasted with in verse 6 with the idea of accepting love and searching, that is, the idea of gathering in. To seek, verse 6, to seek has its time, to gather in, to seek has its time, and to lose, or to let loose, or to give up has its time. To lay up has its time, and to throw away has its time. To gather in has a time, and to let loose and throw away has its time. And then it's followed in verse 7 by a reference to clothing, and then speech. These last two, 7 and 8, the next two, 7 and 8, to rend has its time and to sow has its time. Rending, as you may remember, in the Bible is often referenced when it comes to the receiving of bad news. There's the rending of one's clothes, the tearing of the garments as a symbol of mourn and grief and the receiving of tragic news. So there's a time for rending, for receiving crisis and tragedy, and there's a time when you sew up, or you heal, you repair things. There's good news. There's a lot of tragedy. There's some oppositions and contradictions here that and these are examples of what I was talking about. But the following next two couple of verses, the last part of 7 and verse 8, seem perhaps to be a response to the tragedy. When someone sees these contradictions, when someone sees the boundaries, when someone actually perceives the bounded and limited and often tragic experience of existence for human beings, one is brought to silence. And in the next part of verse 7, he says, to keep silence has its time, and to speak has its time. In other words, when calamity strikes, it's almost as if it reduces us, when hard things occur, it reduces us to a kind of reflective silence, realizing that God has, in the scheme of Solomon's worldview, of his view of reality, this is calamity that God has permitted. This is under the providence and control of God. God has permitted this in my life. And then there's this reflection on, I don't understand why. Why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to us? Why do I have to have this experience? And our mouths, as I put it, the silence here is a mouth-shutting realization of being but a small creature in the vastness of God's unfolding universe of creation. It really puts us in our place. And then there's verse 8, to love has its time, and to hate has its time. It seems to me, as he closes this off here, aside from those big issues of birth and death in relation to man's existence and his experience in existence, this last couplet, verse 8, to love has its time, to hate has its time, war has its time, and peace has its time. It seems to me that it's a fitting closure in the sense that, aside from these big issues of existence, these are the bottom line. These are huge, important experiences in man. Love and hate, and the spectrum that they represent in our experience, bracket something about us that's true of us. And war and peace, in a sense, reflect that love and that hate, the realities in human nature and in the fallen human condition. Then in verse 9, he goes to a question. What profit is there to the worker or the laborer from that which he toils? This is a repetition of an observation that he makes in chapter 1 and verse 3, namely, what advantage does man who is the creature who labors at a grievous task? And by the way, all the way through here, I think the notion of task and labor have to be connected with this notion of the task that God has given to man, namely, to live under the sun and try to figure out what this is all about. And Solomon calls that a very grievous, wearisome, difficult task. And it's woven into our comings and goings, our work, our everyday work, our mundane existence. These questions are themes that run through all of our existence. And he says, what advantage does man have? In light of the fact that God has sovereignly appointed all man is and all man accomplishes under the sun, how can we see that man actually gains from all his labor? That's the question that he's repeating here, in the observation that he's repeating. That is, what is true gain? In the writer's scheme of things, in his set of values, he sees all the labor, that all this effort, the wealth, the sensuality, the attempts to pull life from this material and earthly existence that we have, ultimately is not a gain, not a true profit, not a true advantage. It's insubstantial. How can we have true gain that is not destroyed by the actions and foibles of the generations of man, or ultimately destroyed by death? How can we have that kind of gain? He says, I have seen the task, verse 10. I have seen this task, this laborious task that God has given, this troubling work that God has given to man, has given to the sons of men with which to occupy. And interesting, that word occupy has a flavor of fatigue. That is, this labor that we're engaged in unavoidably in this world is something that fatigues us. It's a travail for us. And then in verse 11, he says, he has well arranged everything beautifully in its appointed time. The beauty is found in this, that what is done is not done sooner or later than it ought to be. That the experience that God providentially creates for each of us is arranged, and the word used in the New American Standard text is appropriate. Everything has an appropriate time. But the word actually carries as much the notion of beauty, that it's fitting, that it's right. In the plan and scheme and providential scheme of God, our experiences are appointed beautifully. That is the way God wants them to be. It's not done sooner or later than it ought to be, and every event or detail is a purposeful part of the whole. That's what I think is intended in this notion of being well-arranged, beautifully arranged at an appointed time. And then he says, he has put eternity in their hearts, but he's done so in a way, yet he has done so in a way that man cannot indeed search and find out from the beginning to end the work that God has accomplished. I think what he's getting at there is that God has placed into the core of man's inner nature a desire for things of an enduring eternal nature. But he has done it in a creature who is bounded under the sun and whose experience he has providentially built in contradictory, ironic difficulties, the existence of which we cannot possibly see, comprehend, or experience, that these kinds of experiences are beyond our ability to understand ultimately. From the perspective that God would have as creator, we can't have that perspective right now. He hasn't given that to us. So the creature, in contrast to the creator, is bounded, limited, and has this built-in, ironic, often contradictory experience sprinkled with joys that are the gift of God, And in the midst of it all, he searches for something worth, something that's truly substantial, truly eternal. Ultimately, what man yearns for is the death to death. I think that comes through in the book from beginning to end. I'll close with this quote that I took from Jacques Ellul's book. It's great. In order to be prepared to hope in what does not deceive, we must first lose hope in everything that does deceive. I think that really captures the intent and purpose of the book. In order to be prepared to hope in what does not deceive, eternal, enduring, we must first lose hope in everything that deceives. And I think Solomon, the writer, Koheleth, is saying, our experience, our reality, deceives and ultimately cannot fulfill what we're really looking for. We're a couple of minutes over time here, so I'm going to bring it to a close with prayer. And perhaps at the beginning of next week, we could take some time for questions and answers if you have some. So let's pray together. Father, when we are confronted by the kind of truth that these passages hold for us, we are indeed silenced because we realize how small we are and how great you are. But there is incredible good news, and that we thank you for privileging us to live at a time in the scope of history, in the history of what you're doing with creation, that we understand your plan. We understand the grace and mercy that's been delivered through your Son, Jesus. We thank you for the truth brought through so clearly in this book. And we pray that you will, if need be, break our hearts with it and build it into us at a level that we cannot deny or walk away from. Make it true for us, we pray. Amen.